previously on Accused.
I still think he committed suicide. I'd still say 100%.
It just looked like hell. I mean, it just looked like what you were going to look down at hell and there was a big hole in the ground. That's what it looked like. Big open red hole in the ground.
Like lava?
Like a volcano, yeah.
The lawyers that we had wanted to go after workman's comp.
Almost to a person, everyone said not suicide.
I'm Amber Hunt, and this is Accused, the mysterious death of David Box. Lisa Crawford lived in a rented house in Ross, Ohio, across the street from the Fernald Uranium Processing Plant. Like a lot of people in the area, she wasn't quite sure what that big complex across the street actually produced, and she didn't worry about it either. And then one day she came home and learned that a man had been poking around the water well in her backyard. The next thing Lisa knew, she was being told that she, her husband, and her young son had all been drinking contaminated water.
We were angry. We were mad. How dare you? You know, and little by little, more information is coming out.
Lisa got pissed and stayed pissed for years. She helped create a community group of equally pissed neighbors, and she became a thorn in the side of every public official she encountered.
They were like, oh, you can drink the water. The water won't hurt you. So I took a jug of water and five Solo cups, red Solo cups, which mean a lot now. They didn't mean anything back then. And I just said, you know, if we can drink it, here's you a cup. I poured, nobody would drink it. And you're like, well, if they don't drink it, then why the hell should I give it to my kid?
The case at the center of this season might be a mystery, but one thing is certain about Fernald. It has a body count of more than one. In this episode, we'll explore how the government fought to keep that a secret.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
David Box's family was still reeling from the news that he vanished one night during his shift. They had seen the photos of bone fragments and remnants of metal, but they had also heard the rumors that he'd scaled a fence, and they held out hope he'd soon come home. The uncertainty was torture. Then, in December 1984, about 5 months after David's last shift, they started reading bizarre stories about uranium leaks in both the air and the ground around the uranium processing plant where he worked. While what happened to their father barely made a blip in the news, stories about Fernald were about to explode. The plant would soon be in the New York Times and on the cover of Time magazine. The story caught the attention of local journalists as well.
Well, my name is John Hughes. I got my undergraduate degree in political science and economics. Went back later and got my master's in journalism. I've been a working journalist and educator since 1967.
This is John Hughes, recorded for an oral history in 2001. He teaches photojournalism at the University of Cincinnati. In the late 1980s, his stark photographs of Fernald were featured alongside poetry in a book called Pieces of Fernald.
I don't think I knew about Fernald until there were problems. I can't recall ever hearing about it in casual conversation or even with people who had concerns about social issues. So it must have been the mid-80s, 85, somewhere in there that we were made aware of some problems. And it was at that time that I drove out there with no intent other than to try to find out where this place is.
Hughes had moved to Cincinnati in the early 1970s and was one of the many who assumed Fernald was a feed plant because of...
But the feed plant threw me. And then you saw the water tower that was checkerboard, like Ralston Purina.
It was a reasonable conclusion to draw, he says.
And here you are in a rural community where you might expect to find what anyone could make a conclusion out of a feed plant that had something to do with the agriculture business. So I found that very disarming, thinking of how really unusual this place is in the context of being what it is purported to be. It seems so mundane, yet it seems so evil at the same time, or potentially evil.
Whether this Purina misdirect was meant to trick residents or Russians, it's hard now to say. What we do know is that the plant was built in 1951, about 6 years after the U.S. dropped two horribly effective atomic bombs on Japan to end the Second World War. After a brief recovery period following that show of force, the arms race was officially underway. Everyone wanted nuclear weapons, and lots of countries eventually succeeded in getting them. Great Britain, France, China, and of course the Soviet Union. When the Fernald plant was built, it wasn't a secret. Newspaper stories from 1951 cover its construction, and it wasn't cloaked as a dog food factory either. One story in the Enquirer began, quote, "Construction of the Atomic Energy Commission installation at Fernald, Ohio, which is destined to play a vital role in the nation's atomic energy program in peace or war, is getting into high gear," end quote. Later in the story, it's explained that the $30 million site, sprawling across 1,050 acres, would, quote, "refine uranium ore." Bob Kispert was one of the plant's earliest employees. He told us,
"You have to turn back the clock to 1954 when I graduated from high school. And Fernald plant was being built. And it was the buzz in the city, you know, people, they're building the new bomb plant. I did well in chemistry, and I applied for a job and was hired as a lab tech."
That was the beginning of a more than 50-year career. Getting hired at Fernald was a big deal. The place paid well, and it had a co-op program, so recent high school grads like Kispert could work at the plant while getting their college degrees at the University of Cincinnati. Kispert studied engineering for 5 years, then left for a 2-year stint in graduate school.
And it just happened that when I was finished there, they had another opening. And I said, well, I like it. And been there ever since.
It might be tough to imagine now, but back in the 1950s, working at a nuclear plant was seen not just as a fine job, but as an act of patriotism.
The Cold War was very real.
And at the time, the U.S. was pretty united in who it saw as the bad guys.
It was the Soviet Union. It was generally called the enemy.
The end of World War II was the first and, knock on wood, so far only time a country used atomic weapons. Until then, the average American had only read about test sites. After the bombs exploded, news stories and photos tried to convey the devastation. One Associated Press story said Hiroshima was completely destroyed and the dead too numerous to count. "Practically all living things, human and animal, were literally seared to death," the story read. Another story said the second bomb blew 30% of Nagasaki from the map. Japan was an enemy, one that had bombed Pearl Harbor even, so Americans cheered these headlines. That might sound callous, but those bombs ended the war, which had been the deadliest in history. 85 million casualties are attributed to it. About 420,000 Americans died. The end of this war was welcome, even if it meant wiping cities off the planet. But as the dust settled, public opinion began to shift. Other countries started developing similar weapons. People began to panic as they realized that if there's ever a third world war, it'll likely be nuclear. Which makes Bert the Turtle all the more absurd.
He did what we all must learn to do.
You
and you
and you
and you.
Duck and cover.
This was a cartoon teachers showed kids at school. The goal was no doubt to teach children without panicking them, but it was about as unsettling as it would be to watch Barney the Dinosaur talking about school shootings. Parents sent their kids off to school, and the kids came home terrified from duck and cover drills.
The atomic bomb flash could burn you worse than a terrible sunburn, especially where you're not covered.
People who had the means bought or built fallout shelters. They had seen photos of leveled cities, of skeletons littering the ground, the skin and muscle burned clean from the bones. Skin had melted off of children. It's one thing to know your country was the first to use an Armageddon device to end a war. It's another thing entirely to realize everyone else is catching up to you. Then the Soviets tested a 58 megaton bomb in 1961, nicknamed the Tsar Bomba. It was then, and remains today, the most powerful man-made explosion in history, according to the Atomic Heritage Foundation. The blast annihilated buildings 34 miles away from Ground Zero. This explosion was so big that if you took Hiroshima and Nagasaki and combined them, you still wouldn't come close to it. When news spread about this test, people were petrified. They'd been practicing duck and cover? How is hiding under your school desk going to protect you from a 50 megaton bomb?
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
The Tsar Bomba was tested October 30th, 1961. On November 1st, 50,000 women nationwide marched as part of the Women's Strike for Peace to protest nuclear weapons. Their slogan was, "End the arms race, not the human race." Then 1962 brought the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was the closest the U.S. and the USSR got to nuclear war. These were scary times. After two world wars and the debut of atomic weapons, nuclear annihilation just didn't seem that far-fetched. Enter here the peace movement. The 1960s hippies weren't just about long hair and free love. Theirs was a political movement that took root first as an anti-nuclear protest that shifted in the mid-1960s to opposing U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War. The peace sign that came to symbolize opposition to Vietnam actually debuted as a symbol for the United Kingdom's campaign for nuclear disarmament. So by the 1970s, it wasn't as chic as it had once been to work at a nuclear weapons plant. Fernald workers signed documents promising not to talk about their jobs under penalty of law. Cincinnati newspaper coverage lessened, too, dropping from an average of 150 news stories a year to a couple of dozen. To be clear, the stories written didn't hide the plant's purpose. One headline in the Akron Beacon Journal read, quote, "Nuclear waste at Ohio plant manages to keep low profile," end quote. People who paid attention could find out what happened at Fernald. But let's face it, Attention spans weren't much better in the 1980s than they are today. With Fernald lying low, people sort of forgot about it. Even people like Lisa Crawford, who in 1984 lived across the street in a house she rented with her husband and their 7-year-old son.
And the funny thing is, I had applied for a job here, and they never called. I thought, gosh, you know, I could go right across the street and go to work, because I was a secretary for years.
We interviewed Lisa at the Fernald Preserve on a beautiful summer day. That's why you hear some bird sounds in the background. Lisa said the plant was as mysterious as it was sprawling. She knew it was the area's largest employer, and she knew it paid well.
What is this place? What are they? Nobody knew what it was, what they did, nothing. The neighbors all thought it was a Purina dog chow plant.
When you applied, what did you think they did?
I wasn't sure exactly. My husband said they always called it the atomic plant. And you think, well, what's that? You know, we're young. We don't know. And the big sign out at the end of the driveway said Feed Materials Production Center. It had a red and white checkerboard thing in the corner. And it also had a little Dutch boy paint thing in the corner, which kind of like people thought, well, you know, it's a feed place. You know, we don't know.
The jobs at Fernald were sought after. Tradesfolk like David Box were lured by decent paychecks. We have David's employment records, which show he had been given several raises over the years. His base pay when he disappeared was about $22,000 a year, or $54,000 in today's money. And he earned a fair bit of overtime on top of that. Beyond the pay, there was a sense of patriotism that came with a career. There's something kind of romantic about working a job meant to help safeguard your country. Lisa never heard back about her job application, but Fernald still became a huge part of her life in short order.
So then all of a sudden, the guy who owned our property came and said, well, they've been testing wells, and your well is one of the contaminated wells. So right away, you know, you think, gosh, I've got a child, and, you know, what does this mean? We don't know what uranium is. We don't know what milligrams and all this. This is stuff that none of us know.
It turned out that the wells in the area were routinely tested by the company for uranium contamination. Homeowners were alerted, but Lisa wasn't a homeowner. She was a renter. When her landlord told her that her well tested positive, she looked at her son and freaked out. Her landlord said she shouldn't worry, that the contamination was minor, but she wasn't about to take his word for it. She called the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency and the Ohio Department of Health and demanded they each test the well and give her second opinions. They each did and gave her two entirely contradictory opinions.
So the EPA letter came back pretty quick and said, find another source of drinking water, and had the results. And, you know, there was strontium 90, there was uranium, and they were like, find another source of drinking water. So we started buying bottled water, you know, you do all that stuff.
But how do you feel when you get that letter? Because
you feel really angry and you feel really like, oh my God, what have I done? What have I... My little boy used to play in a swimming pool there. You get a shower every day. You wash your clothes every day. You know, every time you get in the shower, you put your kid in the bathtub, you think, God, what have I done? The Ohio Department of Health letter came back and said, oh, it's fine. It won't hurt you. You can drink it. So which one do you pick? I picked the EPA letter. And we let the people who owned the property know that, you know, you got to do something. You got to provide water, and we got to get the hell out of here.
Graham Mitchell was Lisa's main contact at the Ohio EPA. He didn't know much about Fernald until his boss approached him in late 1984 to check out some rumblings about issues in the area.
That's how I got involved. And so by 85, I was sampling Lisa Crawford's groundwater well and a whole bunch of other wells in that area.
Several wells were contaminated, but Lisa's case was special for a specific reason.
So that situation was kind of bizarre in that, so Lisa's well was contaminated, who knows for how long, but some years, I'm sure. And DOE knew it. And they told the landowner, because Lisa was renting the property, they told the landowner, And then they or the landowner never told her. I don't know the exact times or dates that happened, but I know that that's the case. And Lisa could probably give you more details on that.
Yeah, it's my understanding that she was a renter helped her footing, because other ones, like the homeowners, had been told and kind of dismissed it, but she wasn't given the opportunity to dismiss it because she was never told, right? So, okay. Right. Lisa had been set to move anyway soon because she and her husband were building their dream home. Problem was, they were building it just a mile down the road. Their Fernald worries were slightly lessened, but not erased, by the move. Lisa stayed angry and stayed vocal. Officials said she was overreacting, that her water was fine to drink. That's when she filled red Solo cups from her well and offered them up at a public meeting. No one was willing to drink. Lisa had never dealt with reporters before, but she quickly learned how to keep a story in the headlines.
I became the media darling, which I had never done before. And I mean, every day it was an interview or something.
She's not exaggerating about her media darling role. When I dug through archived newspaper stories looking for Lisa and Fernald mentioned together, I found her quoted more than 700 times, and that's just in Ohio. Multiple TV news shows featured her, too. The community group she helped create was called FRESH, an acronym for Fernald Residents for Environmental Safety and Health. FRESH had a lot of members, but Lisa ended up being the face of the organization. She felt it was her job, her duty, to keep a spotlight on Fernald, not just for her kid, but for everyone's kids. She took it upon herself to learn everything she could about the plant, its purpose, and its owners.
And God, they hated us. They literally hated us. And they would you can't come in, nothing. Very little information.
Here's what she learned. Fernald was not and had never been a feed production company like so many of her neighbors thought. It was a uranium processing plant owned and operated by the U.S. Department of Energy, a federal agency. If you picture this tale as a 1980s movie, DOE officials would definitely be the bad guys. I asked Lisa.
So is it fair to say that the government lied to people here?
In the early years, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Kisper wasn't sure that was fair. So
it's a fair, I think it's very fair. Absolutely.
Here's how they lied. And note, if you've watched the recent HBO series Chernobyl, parts of this will sound familiar. It's the same era, the same industry, and some of the same fibs, albeit told by a different government. First, the DOE insisted that the plant was totally safe. Yes, uranium was refined there, but the radioactivity exposure was minimal. Weldon Adams, then Fernald's assistant center manager, was quoted in 1983 as saying, quote, "You could sit on an ingot of uranium and probably nothing would happen, but you wouldn't want to sit on a gram of radium," end quote. It's true that the effects of radium are far more immediate and severe than uranium, so in that way, Adams is partly right. You wouldn't want to sit on radium. But uranium isn't danger-free. You've no doubt heard about Marie Curie, who did tons of experiments with radium and polonium. Those are far more radioactive, and at first, they got way more attention because they were more exciting than uranium. Curie had no idea initially just how dangerous these things were, though. She would carry vials of the stuff in her lab coat pockets. Radium seemed really cool. I mean, it could glow in the dark. Some watchmakers in the 1910s hired teenage girls to paint the watch numbers with radium. Those so-called radium girls would use their mouths to bring the paint brushes to a fine point. The girls started dying in the 1920s. Some of the girls literally fell apart as they died, as in their jawbones crumbled in their own hands, the radium having displaced the calcium in their bones. Polonium was so dangerous that we've never found much of a use for it aside from eliminating static electricity in machines and textile mills. It makes a hell of a poison, though. In 2006, it was used to kill a Russian defector and journalist named Alexander Litvinenko, who'd been a fierce critic of the Kremlin. A public inquiry later found that now President Vladimir Putin had likely ordered the assassination, which took weeks and was painful. Here's Stephanie Malin, an associate professor of environmental sociology from Colorado State University, who sounds a little breathy because I caught her rushing around after class.
In a nutshell, uranium is the first end of the nuclear fuel cycle, right? And so it's kind of invisible to most of us. We tend to think of nuclear weapons and nuclear power separate from uranium, right? But it's basically part of carnotite ore. It's the heaviest element. It's obviously naturally radioactive. And until about, the late 30s, it was just kind of discarded because it wasn't really understood that it was valuable along with radium.
We don't use radium or polonium much anymore, but uranium is another matter. It became a Cold War commodity because it not only was radioactive, but it was what's called fissionable. Nuclear fission is when an atom splits in two. That releases energy. That energy can be used for all sorts of scary bomb-related purposes, but also some less scary ones like creating nuclear fuel to power submarines or aircraft carriers. A fun fact from the World Nuclear Association: about 11% of the world's electricity is generated from uranium in nuclear reactors. 20% of the United States electricity comes from the nearly 100 reactors operating here. Uranium is less radioactive than the stuff Curie studied. It would take higher doses or longer-term exposure for someone to get sick. You might feel and seem fine for years, even decades, but prolonged exposure could be deadly. The government knew this by the 1950s. They knew because uranium miners had higher rates of lung and renal diseases.
Part of the issue with that is it's caused a lot of environmental justice and health issues, in that even though our government knew that there were dangers, that was not something that folks who worked in the mines or worked in the mills in the 40s or 50s were notified about.
We know David was at least aware of some safety issues at Fernald because his former coworkers say he was quick to tell them about hotspots they should avoid. As Harry Easterling told Unsolved Mysteries,
Dave was a fairly quiet guy, but if you worked on a job and say it was high radiation level, Dave would tell you, say, you know, that particular dust collector is fairly radioactive, so watch yourself, or that pump has a certain kind of acid in it, so be careful when you work on it.
His kids wonder, was David worried enough about plant safety to threaten sounding an alarm?
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ben Kaufman was a reporter at the Enquirer in the 1970s and 80s. He eventually covered Fernald, learning all about the hunks of uranium they produce called billets. He said that when he started,
I had no clue that there was a problem out there. In those days, when you took a tour, you got the comic book, Your Friend the Atom, and they told you the most dangerous thing with all that uranium was that if one of those billets fell on your foot, you would break it, and it would.
He didn't know the dangers at first, but he at least knew what the plant was supposed to do.
Not because I was smart, but because the Enquirer had wonderful library and clippings. And I went and looked up Fernald, and it said, oh, this is the place they're opening in a building as part of the Cold War nuclear weapons program to refine uranium ore into metal uranium to be used in weapons. There was no secret at the time. But over the years, a cult of secrecy had grown up. And I think we would probably call it willful ignorance, too.
The Enquirer covered small-scale news stories related to Fernald up until 1984. There would be a headline here or there about job promotions or environmental testing or other barely newsworthy happenings. Occasionally, something more foreboding would hit the paper, like in 1971, when a resident complained about how a stream near Fernald he crossed daily en route to work wasn't crystal clear like it used to be. He said, quote, "Now there is often some substances coating the banks and the liquid flowing. It ought to be water, but looks more like milk," end quote. He spelled out that the change happened after the site became an atomic plant. Like most journalists, Kaufman had more than one beat, one of which was covering quartz. His first real uh-oh story about Fernald ran in February 1984, 4 months before David Box disappeared. That story was about a woman who filed a lawsuit against National Lead of Ohio, Inc., the company that ran the plant, for contributing to her husband's cancer death. The man who died was Augustus Abbott. He started working at Fernald when it opened and still worked there when he died in 1982. His widow, Nancy, sued NLO for $2.5 million, saying that NLO knew the dangers of uranium but didn't warn workers. She was at least the second widow to file a suit blaming Fernald for her husband's death. The other involved a truck driver named Raymond Edwards. In both suits, the news stories were brief and never followed up. Despite my attempts, I haven't yet found the outcome of either one. Now, radioactivity has benefits. X-rays are electromagnetic radiation. Cancer cells can be destroyed by carefully directed radiation therapy. Still, it's important to note that we've been under no delusion that radiation is safe for easily 100 years. Radiologists who worked with radiation in the early part of the 20th century regularly fell sick with leukemia. It's why we wear lead aprons when getting certain X-rays. But those early news stories about wrongful death suits filed against Fernald quoted company officials dismissing any suggestion of health concerns. Up until those lawsuits, Kaufman says,
"Well, we really weren't writing much. It had been chugging along for a couple decades, and nobody had any problems with it. I think it was 1984. We finally, the public in the paper, we know the groundwater was poisoned. I don't know how much we know about the radiation risk today, because it was low-level radiation, but it was on them for years."
The water supply issue was the first to raise concerns, because when you drink uranium, the problem isn't just its radioactivity. Uranium is naturally occurring in small doses, but if you ingest too much of it, it can wreak havoc on your body. According to the World Health Organization, ingested uranium enters the bloodstream quickly. You urinate some of it out, but small amounts accumulate in the kidneys and the skeleton. It takes about 15 days for the uranium strength to reduce by half. The half-life in the skeleton is far longer. Uranium can hang out in your bones for longer than 3 months. Some studies even put it at a couple of years. The symptoms of acute uranium toxicity are pretty unsettling. Studies using rats found that some of the rodents lost weight and started hemorrhaging from the eyes and legs and nose. Scientists found microscopic changes in the thyroid and aorta, as well as lesions on livers and kidneys. Severe kidney damage can follow, and that damage is sometimes irreversible. Imagine learning you've been serving your kid water from a well that could cause any of this.
You know, by this point, I'm doing interviews, I'm crying on the television, I'm worried about my baby, and...
That's Lisa Crawford again. After her well was found to be contaminated, her life changed, and not just because she did a few interviews on the local news. By her own description, she was catapulted from small-town housewife to environmental advocate. Fighting Fernald became an all-out mission.
I had never flown on an airplane, ever. I flew to D.C. and testified before Congress. I was scared shitless, man. It was like, I'm on this plane and this little boy sitting next to me going, wouldn't it be cool if we landed on the water? And I'm like, oh, my God. And, you know, sitting in front of Congress is kind of scary. But I was angry.
She had written several pages to deliver to Congress and wasn't finished when a yellow light popped on and a man told her to wrap up her comments.
And I thought, I got 5-6 more pages, and I just kept reading. And the red light came on, and he said, Miss Crawford, I said, you paid for me to get here today. You flew me here. You put me in a real expensive hotel overnight. By God, I'm not getting up and leaving until I finish reading what I have written here. Not another word was said.
That was the first of several congressional hearings Lisa attended.
We tortured our elected officials. I mean, tortured them.
It wasn't just time-consuming. It sometimes felt downright dangerous. 10 years before all this unfolded at Fernald, a woman in Oklahoma named Karen Silkwood had testified before Congress to whistleblow on safety violations at a plutonium plant where she worked. On November 5th, 1974, a detector at work showed she had high levels of radioactive contamination. Her home even tested positive, including the bologna in her fridge. A week later, she left an evening union meeting to meet up with a New York Times reporter, supposedly bringing with her documentation supporting her claim that Kara McGee, the company that owned the plant, was knowingly negligent. She never made it to the meeting. Her body was found later that night inside of her car. She was killed in what appeared to be a single car crash. None of the documents she supposedly had been bringing to the reporter were found with her. In 1983, the year before David Box disappeared, Meryl Streep starred as Silkwood in an eponymous movie. It was a huge hit, making $35 million and earning 5 Oscar nominations. It also was part of a string of films in the 80s that centered on nuclear warfare. The China Syndrome, The Chain Reaction, War Games, Miracle Mile, Threads, Hell Comes to Frogtown. The nuclear industrial complex was not exactly portrayed in the best light. So when Lisa Crawford spoke out about Fernald, she had a sense it might come at a price. And this is important to understand because this feeling of danger is crucial when you're trying to grasp why David Box's family could even come to think that his knowledge of safety lapses at Fernald might have cost him his life. There were stories, fresh ones, real ones, circulating around this time about people said to have been killed for whistleblowing.
I toured the site one day. There's a machine you stand in and it scans you and whatever. And I had contamination on my hands. You know, you're like, oh, okay. I figure I've had my dose, you know, God. I've been here so many times. And the guy said, well, what did you touch? Hello? I've been on a tour. We went up and down steps, you know. And you have visions in your head of they're going to drag me off here and they're going to scrub my body down and they're going to take my clothes. And you have these horrible visions because we've seen Silkwood. And people would say to me, you know what they did to Karen? You know what they did to her out at McGee? And I'd say, yeah, okay, I'm not scared. I was threatened. My life was threatened a few times. My family's life was threatened. That really made me mad. And I had a big top union guy out of AFL-CIO out of D.C. say to me one day, keep your face on the news, your picture in the paper, don't be quiet, tell them what they got to hear, and nobody will bother you. So that's what I did. I think my husband got scared a few times, you know. Used to be a little red car that followed me around sometimes. We laughed about it because there was we were always 2 or 3 or 4 of us together, you know. Yeah, follow me. I think we all think our phones were tapped a few times in the early years. Yeah. I used to pick it up and say, I'm going to call my mom now. Do you want to listen? I mean, we became smart alecks mostly. Wow. So
when you say life-threatened, can you, what are you
talking about? A message was left on my answering machine that they were going to kill me. Ah, come on, you know. Deep down in your gut, you're kind of like, ah, okay. So I always made, you know, at that point, my husband and I made sure we had our wills, we had everything legally you know, done. In case something would happen to you, you want to make sure your kid's taken care of.
This role Lisa played dragged on for years.
We were maybe 8 years in, and my husband said to me one day, I mean, you know, we're all working a full-time job. You've got a child. Your house isn't clean anymore, and you're lucky if they eat and the laundry's done. And my husband said to me, maybe it's time to quit. And I said, I can't. We can't. We can't quit.
And they didn't. They kept hammering the DOE until they got more and more of the information they wanted. The Ohio Environmental Protection Agency started fighting alongside them, giving them more leverage. This meant that a major state agency was butting heads with a federal one. Here's Graham Mitchell of the Ohio EPA again.
DOE was not necessarily, you know, not telling us. They weren't, that their culture was secrecy and security. So they were not a culture that was open to, like, talking about, you know, what their problems. They never had that. They didn't have anybody on staff that was like a communications expert or anything like that. That was not their strong suit.
But even when the DOE started backing down and acknowledging that maybe it hadn't been as, let's say, forthcoming as it should have been, there was no kumbaya moment. To this day, there are people who worked at Fernald who seem to be in a strange sort of denial about what happened there. Remember Bob Kispert, the guy who started working at Fernald right after high school? Here's us talking.
If I went to work every day and had been told that things were safe, and then learn through lawsuits that they weren't, and that my bosses knew that, I would be angry.
I think people were.
Were you?
Angry, no, because I felt safe.
Okay, why?
Because I felt safe. I didn't feel threatened.
Okay, so even though there were scientists pointing to real hard violations of these standards, you still thought, well, they told me it's safe, so it's safe.
Well, I think the interview is about over.
Next time on Accused.
The government and whoever was running the plant continued to deny the reality.
We won that case, Einstein. He didn't die of uranium poisoning. He died of a potassium deficiency.
All right, well, they know who was the person who killed him, but apparently nobody's got the gumption to stand up and say anything.
To binge this season, go to www.wondery.com/plus. That's WONDERY.com/PLUS. To support the creators of Accused directly, go to our Patreon page where donors get bonus content and early episodes. That's at patreon.com/accused. This is a special project from the Cincinnati Enquirer, part of the USA Today network, narrated by Amber Hunt, produced by Amanda Rossman, engineered by Phil Didion, and edited by Amy Wilson. Intern Mark Rosenberg provided additional research. Music was composed by Andrew Higley. To look at case documents, photos, videos, and more, visit accusedpodcast.com. As noted, some audio comes from a Living History project from the Fernald Community Alliance. Transcripts to those interviews are available at fernaldcommunityalliance.org.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill. or text THRILL to 500-500.